Today on Wings.
In our society, exchange has become sort of the archetype of everything. All of our human relations are based on that ego-oriented giving in order to get back. The logic of exchange, giving in order to get, is a very different logic from giving in order to satisfy a need. And in fact, giving and receiving are both really important. If a gift is not received and not received creatively and used, it might as well not ever have been given.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
I'm Frieda Worden, co-founder and current series producer of WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service, now in our 37th year. From the WINGS archive, here is my 1997 interview with peace activist and gift economy theorist and my longtime friend and friend of WINGS, Genevieve Vaughn.
The philosophy that I've been developing over many years now is a feminist philosophy based on promoting the gift economy. And I think that gift giving is a real economic way that's based on mothering, sort of a nurturing way of doing things. And giving gifts and receiving gifts creates bonds among people. And when you are nurtured, you have to also creatively receive what is given to you. Giving and receiving are both really important, not just giving. If a gift is not received and not received creatively and used, it might as well not ever have been given. So giving and receiving are both sides of a gift-giving way that's based on mothering, on the mother's ability to look at a child's needs and satisfy those without expecting anything in return. Exchange, on the other hand, is giving in order to receive, and that requires an equation, an equivalence between what is given and what is received. And there is an ego orientation of exchange, because you give in order to get back, and you yourself are the object of your action, whereas in giving, the other person is the object of your action. It's more transitive, let's say.
Well, it does seem as if the trend in modern society and modern scholarship is to look at everything in terms of economics and everything in terms of business economics, you know, like what is a deal? What is that exchange? And you're saying that you think that this is not really an accurate reflection of the society, that we shouldn't be thinking of it in terms of this kind of money quid pro quo society?
Right, that's what I think. In fact, it's not just a question of money, but it's a question of money as a means of exchange. The dividing line is between gift-giving on the one hand and exchange on the other, not between a moneyed economy and an unmoneyed exchange economy like barter would be. The logic of exchange itself, giving in order to get, is a very different logic from giving in order to satisfy a need. And in fact, in our society, exchange has become sort of the archetype of everything. All of our human relations are based on that ego-oriented giving in order to get back.
So like the United States, the government justifies its foreign aid program because it says, well, we're not really just giving to these people that need something. We're actually getting back more than we put out.
Making it look like a gift when actually it's a hidden exchange. That mm-hmm. happens a lot too, and it gives gift-giving a bad name.
Yeah, I mean, Ayn Rand thought that gift-giving was really terrible, that altruism concealed real horrible personalities who were getting something back. But you completely disagree. But you're basing your ideas on what? Your experience as a mother and also your experience as a philosopher. Would you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, first of all, I just want to reply to that about Ayn Rand, who I think was a pawn of patriarchy. And I think her ideas are very functional to the kind of patriarchal capitalism that we have in this country and to the ego domination, which is part of patriarchy at any rate. Yes, I do base what I have developed on the gift economy from partly my own experience as a mother, as opposed to the rest of experience in the society that I had. A lot of times I just didn't agree with things that I was being taught, and I didn't know why until I finally realized that as a woman, I was reasoning on a different wavelength from a lot of the reasoning that was going on in the society at large. And I do think that the exchange type reasoning is validated in our society, and the gift-giving reasoning is unvalidated or devalued, even though I think it is very pervasive. I think it's much more prevalent than we actually realize.
You know, it's interesting to me that you came from a very wealthy family. I mean, you're from a very wealthy family. And among the poor give, for instance, a higher percentage usually of their income to charity than the wealthy do. So I'd say, especially in the culture that you were raised in, gift giving must be especially devalued. Do you feel that that's the case?
No, not really. I think that a lot of wealthy people use charity as a sort of release of steam from the exchange economy that they have made their money in. And in fact, the gift-giving way, the mothering way, is a very humanizing thing and is very good for us to do it. But I don't think that charity is the way out. I think that we need to shift the paradigm of the whole society onto a gift-giving way, and when we do that, charity will become unnecessary. Up until now, I think charity has only been used to sort of defuse the worst, most explosive situations that are there because of the economic injustice.
You're talking about what, restructuring the whole society so that everyone would be watching for what people's needs are and satisfying them and giving from what was available?
Yeah, and I think that actually that kind of society really is possible, but we have created scarcity on purpose so that that kind of society can't happen, because a society where gift-giving can work really needs to be based on abundance. There needs to be enough there for people to give to other people without having to sacrifice themselves. And that way, it lets us look at the needs and satisfy those needs with abundant goods rather than having to sacrifice in order to give something to somebody else. And I think that the kind of economics that we have is set up to not allow that kind of thing to happen. So scarcity is created artificially by spending enormous amounts on armaments, for example. $18 billion is spent every week on armaments worldwide, and that would be enough to feed everybody on Earth for a year. So you can tell it's a huge hemorrhage of wealth out of the economy. In fact, there are people who say that wars are created in order to create markets for the arms businesses. So we've really gotten things upside down now. We have the ability to make peace with each other, but we can't do that and spend billions of dollars on armaments. We have to be able to find a way to allow abundance to accrue in our societies and satisfy the needs, instead of creating these hierarchical social structures where the poor give to the rich and the money is siphoned up and away from the needs and into a profit structure instead of paying attention to the needs and satisfying them. So we do have, you know, 40,000 children who die every day of hunger and preventable diseases. And that is unnecessary, and we really should not be doing that. And I think that as a mother, speaking with other women who are mothers and who also were brought up as women and to give life and to nurture life, I think we can all agree that that kind of thing, the deaths of thousands and millions from starvation, is simply unacceptable, and it's horrible for those of us who are living in a world where that doesn't happen to some of us and does happen to others. Even the ones of us it doesn't happen to have to become responsible and make it stop.
Well, that some of our most prominent philosophers are saying that the only way we can possibly have enough wealth to feed everybody would be by taking everything and putting it into the private sector, that this is the only place that wealth is created. Where do you think that wealth is created, and how can we create enough wealth to meet the needs?
I'm not really sure that is the right way of posing the question.
Okay.
I don't think really that what we're talking about basically is wealth. I think the whole market system is based on exchange. It is a patriarchal system of domination of the few over the many, and that is facilitated by funneling the wealth into the hands of the few. What we need to do is not have this patriarchal economic system anymore and create a feminist, mother-based economic system in which needs are the most important thing. And we might see needs as a kind of wealth, because no goods are useful unless there are needs that can use the goods. And there are needs at many different levels. Once your basic needs are satisfied, you can have more complicated needs, up to the needs for artistic expression, communication of all kinds. And of course, now at this point, we really need to concentrate on the big social needs that have been created through patriarchy, that is, the environmental needs, for example, the destruction of the environment, and the needs like we were talking about before, which are the needs of the very many, the needs of billions of people who are suffering because of the economic systems that we're living under. And I want to go back again to what I was saying about a mother-based economy.
Okay.
I believe that communication itself really comes from giving and receiving. When I satisfy somebody else's need, I have communicated with them. I have created a community with them by actually helping to form their body, for example, when I feed them.
Mm.
And I see that as a kind of communication. So even verbal communication is a sort of imitation of that material communication. And we also form
our
their
communities
minds. Verbally also, so that we create one another's subjectivities as we satisfy each other's communicative needs as well as our material needs. And we've gotten away from that in our economics that we have now and in patriarchy, because we are always involved in this domination, submission, tension, where some people are competing with others in order to be the first and the biggest and the best. And that is really not a very helpful model for making peace on earth and each one's needs be satisfied. We've looked away from needs, and we've looked at this ego dominance way so much that we are really sacrificing all of humanity, all of the other creatures and the planet to this distorted logic.
I wondered, why is it that it seems that the men have gotten farther away from this than the women have, that they've been more sucked into that other economy? And you have some kind of theory about how males are defined in our society. Would you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I think that from the very beginning, when the doctor or the nurse says it's a boy, the child is defined as being different from his nurturing mother. So he has to learn to be not nurturing in order to follow a gender mandate, a sort of whatever it is that he has to do to have a male identity in this society. And he doesn't really usually know what that is, also because I think that this giving and receiving way is the basic way human beings are formed. In fact, I think that instead of calling ourselves Homo sapiens, we should call ourselves Homo donans. That is a giving being or a giving and receiving being.
So Homo sapiens is what? The wise being, as we've been taught to call ourselves, and Homo donans would be the being that gives.
Right. And I think that the knowing or the sapiens, the being or the animal that knows, really all of that knowing is based on giving and receiving. Because I think that as we know, we become grateful for our experience. We are really able to know as a response to the experiential data, which is a word for givens, and we respond to the world at large as a gift unconsciously, and that is our knowledge itself. So it's sort of a gratitude-based theory of knowledge.
On Wings, you are listening to an interview with Genevieve Vaughn, recorded in 1997, when her first book, Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange, was about to be released. She has since written and edited at least 7 more books that are published in several languages. Her most recent title is The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning.
How did you come to start to think like this, which is so different from the main flow of attitudes in the society?
Well, I'm really not that unusual as far as I can tell. I was born in Corpus Christi, Texas, from a wealthy family, which actually got wealthier as I grew up. And I was just thinking back over, you know, how did it happen that I had a social interest from the beginning? And I guess maybe because we had people that were working for us at the time that were really very wonderful, good people, and they were people of color, and I loved them. And so when I would go places either with them or, for example, to Mexico, which was nearby, and saw so much poverty there, I wondered, how could it be that we were wealthy and those people were so poor? And why were they suffering and we were not? And finally, as I grew up and kept asking myself this question, somebody, actually it was the man I married eventually, convinced me that it was because people were poor that we were rich, that there was a flow of goods and wealth from poor people to wealthy people. And part of that was because, you know, the work that they were doing was basically unpaid that came to us, that wealth that came to the wealthy people. And so I realized that that was something that needed to be changed if we were going to have everyone's needs satisfied.
Did your family accept this in you, that you wanted to change the world?
Well, they kind of made fun of me back then anyway when I was growing up. But I got married when I was 23, and I went and lived in Italy for 20 years, and I got a whole other perspective there. It was during the Vietnam War, and all kinds of things were happening, and I could see the U.S. from the outside, and the U.S. looked really awful as the perpetrator of the Vietnam War. And I had to sort of, I hated the Vietnam War also, and I had to sort of try to explain to the Italians this country that I was from that was doing this, and that was a difficult thing to do. And after that, I became a feminist and was part of the feminist movement in Italy and went to consciousness-raising groups there. And that was a very exciting time, and I must say I learned a whole lot. Then, at that time, my husband, who I finally ended up getting a divorce from, had thought that you shouldn't be using your money to give to people, to individuals. I had not started using my money at all until I was around 40, after I got a divorce. And I understood that I should use it for social change projects, not for individuals, because as he was right, I think, when he said, if you give your money to individuals, it'll just go to them and it won't change society at all. You just won't have it and they will. So after that, I really developed the idea that you should give the money to social change projects, projects that have a real multiplier effect. Of course, they do involve individuals, but those individuals are working for wider social change. And that's what I've been doing since then, since 1983, and it's now 1997. It's been a long
time. Almost 97, yeah.
And I've used up most of the money that I inherited, and I think it's been used really well. I'm glad I did it.
Well, I think it's been used really well, too, and I appreciate the support that you've given to WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service, to report on the women's movement around the world. And so many projects that you have done that I've admired.
Thank you, Frida.
Thank you. I'm hoping that you can tell us about the scope. I realize it's almost mind-boggling, the scope of the work of the Foundation for Compassionate Society and the social change work that you have been behind.
I'd like to say from the beginning that I lived in Italy for 20 years and came back here in 1983. So I had this sort of international perspective when I came back, and I believed then, as I do now, that the women's movement in the U.S. is part of a much larger context, which is the international women's movement. And so a lot of the programs and projects that are part of the Foundation for Compassionate Society express that. We always have an international element, and we always try to listen to things that are going on internationally. And some of the projects have been directly international. For example, the project in Germany, which has been going on now for quite a few years, started with a couple of women who did a peace caravan internationally and helped do our peace tent that we did in the Nairobi conference in 1985.
That was the United Nations' third World Conference on Women, by the way, for listeners, that was held in Nairobi, Kenya in 1985 for the end of the decade for women. And I believe that it must have been your idea or yours and your associates' idea to have this peace tent in the first place, right?
Right. It was actually a really wonderful experience to do that. I had started this funding stuff just a couple of years ahead of that, and my interest was definitely in peace and women as peacemakers and exemplars for peace. And so it was right up my alley. And I had started, actually, together with some other women, another group a couple of years before that, which was an international women's group with women from a lot of different countries. And so together with the people from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, we talked about what to do in Nairobi. And the idea came up that peace and justice and so forth were not women's issues, not supposedly women's issues, that women at the conference were supposed to be concentrating on domestic violence and not on international violence. And so the reason we did the peace tent was to give a space to women to talk about international violence, which is so much really a women's issue, because women are so often the victims of war that they do not create, and because the war causes devastation that women have to then clean up.
Really?
And for so many other reasons, the depletion of the economy through war, which is really male hormones gone wild.
They certainly waste the resources, don't they?
They do.
But, you know, that peace tent idea, I was in Mexico City for the first conference of the decade for women. And I remember being sort of shocked to see the women from the different countries mouthing the slogans of their countries and, you know, and speaking against each other. Kind of the mouth of war was still on those women, the official women. And so when I heard about this peace tent that you'd established in Nairobi 10 years later, I thought, what a fabulous idea to find a place where women can speak, you know, not out of their government's rhetoric, but to speak personally to one another. Did that work out? I mean,
I wasn't really there. Did. Yeah, it worked out beautifully, really. I mean, not that we were always peaceful, because there were a lot of arguments, but that you have to sort of be able to say the terrible things to each other and then be able to go back and say the other things. Because until you say the terrible things, you're holding back something. You're not really telling the truth or what you suspect is the worst truth. And once that's out in the air, then you can go about making peace in a better way. And there were some big fights, but we, the organizers of the tent, we set it up so that the big fights wouldn't happen. Once the first ones happened, we changed it around, and we did songs every once in a while. We read a statement, which we wrote about being peaceful there. We read poems, and we decided not to clap but wiggle our fingers instead as a sign of appreciation. We didn't have applause or booing, and that kept the level of tension down. And it worked out fine after the first couple of days, in which there were some pretty rowdy moments.
Actually, it worked out so well. It has practically become an institution. I mean, all the international conferences have peace tents, you know, like, where's the peace tent going to be? It's become part of the fabric of this.
Yeah, it worked out wonderfully, really. And it was great because we had women from a lot of different countries there that were womaning the tent, that were making it happen. And it was a great collaborative effort. And a few of the women from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom were involved in it as well. But mostly it was this group, which at the time we called Feminist International for Peace and Food, which put it on.
It's a good name still. Yeah.
And which disbanded after that. But the German women that did that then afterwards went and did a peace caravan, which went all through Eastern Europe and into the Soviet Union and back again before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So it was really quite an experience talking to women about peace. And we did those also in the U.S., projects of peace caravans. And even now, there is a peace caravan that just started last year, run by Susan Lee, who's a wonderful peace activist, anti-nuclear activist. And this is an anti-nuclear museum, the Earth and Sky Women's Peace Caravan to End the Nuclear Age. And she goes from town to town and talks about anti-nuclear things and shows people through the museum.
Genevieve Vaughn, founder and president of the Foundation for a Compassionate Society, was originally interviewed by Frieda Worden for the series Wake Up Sister on WALEAM Providence, Rhode Island, and was edited by Suzette Cullen and Frieda Worden.
That was my 1997 interview with Genevieve Vaughn. Soon after, she closed the Foundation for a Compassionate Society and released her first book, Forgiving, a Feminist Criticism of Exchange. She continues to write, speak, and organize events around the gift economy in collaboration with a growing international movement of theorists and practitioners. You can watch their online events at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including Genevieve Vaughn, Suzette Cullen, our contributing producers, and local community radio stations around the world. For more about Wings, email wings@wings.org. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.